Welcome to the Alphaville Journal of Film and Screen Media podcast. Episode 2, a roundtable discussion on the challenges and opportunities of creative practice. This roundtable discussion took place as part of the University College Cork Film and Screen Media Creative Practice Symposium on the 4th of May 2018. The panelists were Professor Julian McDougall, Dr. Romana Turina, Alan Hook, Davide Abestiani, Dr. Laura O'Connor, and Dr. Jill Daniels. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Kira Chambers.
This roundtable discussion is really for the benefit of people who haven't attended the symposium and would like to follow up on some of these ideas. Some of what we've discussed this morning already has been particularly relevant, so I just wanted to lay out a framework for some of the areas that hopefully we can hit in the discussion. Firstly, terminology, how creative practice is defined and some of the issues in defining it. Also how it's conducted, perhaps questions of ethics might come up. How it's supervised, how it's theorised, how it's peer-reviewed as well, and how it's published. So those are kind of the areas, and other areas might come in, like the viva, for example. What does a creative practice viva look like? So we'll try and keep broadly in those discussions, and we may not hit all of them, but we'll try. So I'll maybe start with terminology. And Julian, I was particularly interested in your model of into, through, for. So I'm wondering, in terms of defining creative practice, we often have a confusion around practice-led versus practice-based. Can you enlighten us?
Yeah, that's a question I would really hope you wouldn't ask me, particularly. So those are not really my categories. They're a way of thinking about the... to go back to the conversation earlier on, and for those people who weren't present, to maybe kind of rehearse that a little bit, it's... I guess about where the conception of the practice work as research at the moment at which it happens, and whether the practice starts out as a piece of research and has an epistemological or conceptual frame at that moment, or whether it's applied in the middle or if it's applied retrospectively. And it seemed to me, and I may be wrong, so I'll hand over straight away so you can correct me if I am, that the two case studies we had after my talk this morning were different in that respect, in that I think Alan's work starts out as a piece of practice-based research, and I think that the films we saw, perhaps you're conceptualising those as research in a different way now, which is not to say they weren't investigative research in the filmmaking act. So those would now be being considered now as research as practice retrospectively, but you...
They were actually very kind of a mix of things, because they definitely started as a research in the archive. And then I understood that research actually constituted a kind of an important discovery of knowledge, they became a filming. And then, because of the request of the filming, they became other research. So it became really a kind of a cycle of feeding back to each other. And in the way right now, certainly, they can be considered and retrospective, but they can also... I came to understand that the filming helped me very much to think through the questions. So, yes, I don't have a final answer.
I think it's... same with my work, is it's this kind of cycle. So you have a problem, you read a bit about the problem, and then you make a bit, and then you think about whether that solves it, and then maybe it solves part of it, so you write a bit, because words are useful tools to do certain things, but making is a useful tool to do other sorts of things. So then you write a bit, and that doesn't really solve it, so you go back and you read a bit, and you write a bit, and you just keep on iterating through this cycle until you start to get something which starts to congeal into outputs. And sometimes I write and sometimes I make, and it depends. I just see those as two interchangeable tools to think through a problem, and that I'm just trying to work through a series of issues And sometimes for me, words are good tools for that, but they are often locked down in their meaning, whereas meaning can be more emergent through the practice than it can through the writing.
This is, that you say is interesting because it happened more or less the same to me, because I was trying to articulate post-memory in words, and then I said, okay, so I will actually, this is not sufficient. I will add the visual to it, and the first film that you didn't see, it was 10 minutes. It was very typical classic narrative, a story about character and antagonist with a first act, a second, third, which was perfectly good fiction, short film, but it didn't work for the research at all. So there pushed me to break the narrative structure and to try to find out other ways that brought me to the safe film.
In something like the work that I talked about this morning with the horse's head, it was trying to solve a problem, which is how do you take on a viewpoint of another species? So it's a kind of satirical piece because, you know, it's taking on a physical viewpoint, but that's kind of the discipline of speculative design. It's quite very tongue-in-cheek and has a very kind of, I would say, a very English sense of humour around it. But it's trying to work through a process which sometimes comes out in different sorts of ways. So for me, actually, the output isn't going to be the horse's head. It's the series of games that we might play whilst we wear this horse's head and see like a horse. So it's a series of kind of like a situationist, fluxist kind of series of performances that we could put on these horses' heads and run around tracks. Or so that's the actual output, is this probably just a list of two people put on heads and run around a track.
I'm smiling because you've asked for a very kind of simple answer to a simple question. We ended up with situationist flux as we run around track. But one thing I would also just add to it is that we must always remember that methodology and practice-based or practice-led are not the same. So one of the things that gets forgotten in a conversation of this kind is that it may depend upon the research methodology whether the work is conceived as practice-based, practice-led, or research as practice. And there tends to be an assumption that it will automatically or necessarily be, you know, kind of ethnographic because we're making something and we're in the process. But that would not be the case unless ethnographic principles have been really kind of rigorously adhered to as well. So the categories are in relation as well to research methodology.
Maybe we could pursue that a little bit, actually. Laura, you've just finished your PhD, so if you could say something about your methodology and maybe your output and your framework, that would be helpful.
Yeah, well, I was looking at the kind of evolution of feminist performance art and video art on social media, so this idea of representation, so this kind of history of video art that challenges stereotypes and norms and gendered norms, and how this has kind of changed due to the like women creating their own images of themselves and putting them on social media, and this agency or perceived agency. So looking at how social networks kind of work in ways to moderate what gets seen. And so I was looking at artists, contemporary artists who are working in the field as an emerging field. So so I did a series of case studies on a number of artists, and I gave a bit of historical content to like a framework of some work that was made in the 90s and in terms of kind of early online work or internet computer based work, and then looked at strategies. So then tested out different strategies in the studio. So I was kind of looking at how artists were kind of using social networks, and then I would I had created my own alter ego who performed online, and kind of tried to figure out different strategies that could possibly alter how these images are received. So yeah, I was looking at artists' work. I was contextualizing it in terms of theory, and I also looked at a lot of sociology on sociological research on teenage girls online. So there has been a lot of research done in that, but you know, I'm not qualified to do that research, so I'm drawing on the work done. I'm kind of looking at, a lot of it was on like post-feminist theory. I drew a lot from different areas to kind of inform the practice and kind of create this kind of quite nuanced work, I suppose, or that attempted to answer questions. Like, I don't know if I answered anything, but it was looking at the field, creating studio practice, and then kind of creating work in around that and asking those questions.
Did you find that your methodology was set early on, or did it emerge over time or change over time?
I think I kind of, I knew that I was going to do case studies, and I knew that it would, I think probably for me was getting a balance between theory and practice was difficult for me, or when to write and when to make. When do you go to the studio, and you know, how do you work around that? It always changed. I think, you know, on a monthly basis, I'd be like, yeah, this week I'm going to spend 2 days in the studio and 3 days in the office. And then it just wouldn't work. And I'd be like, right, I'm going to spend a week in the studio and a week in the office. And so I think trying to find those balances. I think it was always kind of changing in that respect. I kind of knew how I was going to do it.
And this is something that's interesting for you, Davide,
yeah.
Because you've just recently started out
on
the creative practice PhD. So do you have a sense yet of a methodology emerging?
Yes, but of course, I mean, so what I'm going to say, just based on my very little experience that I started gathering. In my case, since my research is based on the impact of the Great Recession on the Italian and Irish film industries, especially in terms of career prospects for young filmmakers, what I wanted to do is to understand if all these industry trends that we have, all these statistics about the trends of the European cinema, and in particular Italy and Ireland, how much they fit with the reality. So with the experiences that young filmmakers are having at the beginning of their career. I'm talking about absolute beginners, so people who are either trying to enter the industry or the intent they get. So let's say it's pretty complicated to just look at the numbers, because we can see -5%, but what does that mean? That's why I felt the need to start working on the interview as a research methodology, which is basically the practical part of my research. So I started thinking about meeting filmmakers, talking to them, getting the qualitative insights of their experience that the numbers, the industry can't give you, which is so far away from reality. There are lots of people who are struggling, they have talent, but they can't make it. There are many others that maybe were able to enter the industry, and the question is, why were they successful? So, you know, there is such a big phenomenon, such as the Great Recession behind, and it's very interesting to analyze the way the young filmmakers coped with this kind of a cage, because I defined it as a cage. Basically, you are an artist and you have some limitations in terms of budget, in terms of resources, in terms of time, whatever. But then you have to start, you have to cope with this. And I think only filmmaking and only the interview can really open up some of their real experiences. Of course, I'm not like so close-minded, so during my path, I'm ready to slightly change the approach, or maybe to expand it maybe into a more observational mood. Who knows? Because that might be indispensable, you know, to follow a bit the life of a few filmmakers and see what happens. What do they think about when they wake up in the morning? What they're planning to do for the next 6 months? Why did they start doing filmmaking? Because that's the magic sparkle I want to study a little bit. And I think this is very nice to consider, not only for filmmaking, but also for all the other forms of art, because everyone, a dancer, a singer, songwriter, had a sparkle at some point in his life when he was young. Later on, 40, 50, 60, he started thinking, oh God, this should be my life. I need to do this. So that's what I'm trying to study. And I want just to get a more closer feel of what this historic stage is for
young filmmakers, like me included, because I'm in this, I'm part of this generation, you know. So, yeah, but I'm ready to evolve the methodological part in this sense.
Well, it's interesting. I'd like to stay on filmmaking within the academy, and in particular to ask Jill, who's a very experienced filmmaker, about what happens when you begin as an artist to make films within academia, and this notion that perhaps when you make that move, the film should be more about knowledge production than film production, and how do you create new knowledge through that practice within academia?
Yeah, I began my PhD in 2009. Yes, I finished in 2014. And I have been making films for a long time. I was making documentary films. So the subject matter that I was interested in is on memory and place, in particular small places that have undergone sort of trauma and contestation in some way. So I've been making, and identity, contested identity. So I've been making these films for a number of years and feeling quite frustrated because I came from an art background and I was making fiction films originally, which then became very hard to make because I get funding for and so on. And I liked making these documentaries, but I kind of felt I wanted to go further and experiment. And outside the academy, that's quite hard to do, to be able to show the films or, you know, failure, etc. So doing a PhD was actually a really secure environment for beginning to consciously make experiments in terms of strategies and techniques, really, of film practice. So I also felt that I was very lagging behind in film theory during the period that I was making films. And the reason I it wasn't a conscious decision not to be looking at film theory, but when you're on your own, you don't really know where to begin. So I realized when I started teaching, which was 2002, that I was quite behind. And so it was a kind of curiosity in a way. So I had my research questions quite early on, and I knew it would be a practice-led PhD. And I made two films where I knew what I wanted to experiment. So in a sense, they changed because of the reading and because of discussion that I hadn't had, like those kind of intense discussions that you get with your supervisors, who then question you and you get very defensive early on. It's not an easy process at all, and it goes on for a long time. So it's been a kind of extraordinary experience for me, having that period of time to be able to develop and go into experimenting and finding when things didn't work or you felt that they didn't work, and yeah, discovering all the time. And my work since I finished, I think has evolved even from the time that I was doing the PhD. So I've got this kind of grounding now and I can continue thinking about theory. And in some ways I kind of feel within the academy there is always that danger of over-analysis, overthinking, and not being able to have that kind of risk-taking that I think you have to do when you're doing any creative piece of work. So
that's a really interesting point about how it might limit what you create artistically and how you have to perhaps modify your artistic integrity in some way because you have research outputs to make that have to fit a certain criteria as they go through the evaluation process and the Viva and so on. And I just wondered in terms of supervision and guiding you through that process, I think it's really interesting to consider how creative practice supervision differs from traditional academic supervision of a PhD thesis. So I wondered, how did you find that process with your supervisors?
Yeah, that's quite important, really, I think, to learn from the person who's doing the research as much as, you know, not thinking that you know as a supervisor. So, you know, it's actually kind of also doing some research yourself. Because I think any student that you have, you don't know exactly what it is that they're doing. None of us are identical people in our experience and knowledge. So I think there's a kind of learning to be done by the supervisors as well, which I think is useful for both parties, really, all parties concerned, and to grow together. So in some ways, I think for me, the debate about practice-led, practice-based, etc., can change. It may seem practice-led. Mine was practice-led, but the university was quite early on, didn't really know how much writing I should do, and so that was an experiment in itself. And then maybe it has an element of being practice-based, but I'm not terribly sure.
And this is one of the interesting aspects of this whole field. There's so much that's emerging, and there's a lot of trial by error, I think, has taken place. And I wonder, Julian, you've supervised a lot of practice-led, practice-based PhDs, and you've examined a lot of them. Can you see any best practice models emerging in terms of supervision, or would you have any recommendations on that process?
Well, yes, but they're the same best practices that would be the case for any. So when you were talking about the supervisor not being the expert, I would argue that in any PhD I supervise, whether it's practice or not, if it works well, it ought to be that I'm learning more from the student, and you know, I'm the custodian of the system, and I understand how a thesis is structured and how a Viva works, and all the things we talked about today about, you know, the idea of new knowledge. But they should absolutely always be the expert on the work. It is more complicated in practice because there will be a kind of subfield of making. And I actually think the politics of that can be more complicated if you're supervised by somebody who has made, you know, some very prominent films in the field. That's a kind of different sphere of influence to somebody who's written academic papers on something. There's more of a sense of the kind of the personal work that's been invested in that perhaps as well. So I actually think it's kind of slightly more complex in that case. But the best practices are always those when power is handed over to the student to be the expert in the research, and the supervisor's role is to step back in that aspect and to help curate and frame and, you know, and process the work into the right kind of structure. In terms of examining, the best dynamics I've observed are where the internal examiner, either one of the two examiners ought to be somebody who has made work in a similar domain, has that level of expertise, and then the other examiner might take a more generic brief of how practice work is conceptualized as research. And I'm careful what I say now on camera, but I have supervised with a degree of confidence, examined with a degree of confidence, practice PhDs where I really don't have very much expertise in the specific form of making that's being exemplified. But I would only do that if I knew the internal examiner had that. Because this is going to sound extremely crass, but you know, it is possible that something could just be kind of done wrong. Right. And I wouldn't know, because I'm interested in how are you articulating this as research, how are you conceptualising it as new knowledge. But with practice work, there's also craft and technique and skill and endeavour. That wrong is the wrong word, but there are things that must be known about that field, one of the examiners. So it's more complicated, I think, putting those examining teams together, and it's more difficult because conventionally, a PhD examiner must have examined PhDs before, they must have a doctorate themselves. So once these things go to committees, it's a pretty limited gene pool. and perhaps I benefited from that, you know, to some extent. But this will change for sure over time as this field, you know, becomes more confident and robust. There will be many more people, I think, available for employment as external examiners, supervisors and whatever. So It's early days, I think, in that respect.
And Alan, you're in an interesting position because you have supervised PhDs, and then you've gone through the process yourself. And I just wondered how you felt about that mode of supervision. Has the fact that now you're doing a PhD altered the way you supervise in any way?
all the PhDs that I've supervised haven't been through practice. And my PhD is, I don't even know what you categorize it as. I write some words, I make some things, and there's some knowledge in the quagmire of stuff that comes out somewhere. So I guess, I take this a kind of rule of thumb similar to Julian's, which is round about Christmas of the second year, if the student's not teaching me things about the discipline that I don't know, then I have failed as a supervisor to support them in taking ownership over that study and understanding in more depth. Because you'll never supervise somebody who's doing your piece of research, because you're doing your piece of research. Mm-hmm. So they will always be on the fringes of the thing that your area that you're working in, and they should be. It's one of the most rewarding experiences for me as an academic is supervising PhDs, because they're pushing my understanding of my field, and I'm helping support them to kind of drill down further into what they're understanding. So, but it's really different seeing different approaches to supervision between the institution I work at Ulster and the institution I study at Lancaster, and what constitutes as new knowledge. And because I'm working across different disciplines, which would return as different ref panels, so I return as a 34 now, which was 36, and the other and designs in a different panel. So I'm working across different discipline-specific discourses, which is interesting as well, because you start to then fold that back into other pieces of research. So that's been really valuable for me. But even just what constitutes a VIVA, the questions that are asked in a VIVA. What goes in an annotated portfolio, what constitutes a submission of work, what is an output?
Well, maybe can we be can ask different. That actually of Romana and Laura, if you would maybe share your experiences of what your VIVA was like. How much of your practical work did you showcase in it, and how?
Well, in my case, it was really interesting actually, because, well, York is relatively new about, you know, with creative practice, PhD, so. In my case, I reached the VIVA after I had pushed the boundary of the initial legal requirement three times, and they had adjusted them because it just didn't work. And in the VIVA, I produced about 50,000 words of one piece of archival research that was 100 years history of Italian cinema, where I picked all the films talking about Fieste and analyzed what they were doing. And through that, then, I justify why I wanted to make films and what was that they were supposed to do, to be doing. Produce the films. I produced an hour and 10 minutes of film, which they view, and then on top of that, the conclusion, the reflections on the creative practice, which linked the questions to the answers that were reflective of what I found in the research in Italian cinema. This was the discussion in the VIVA was very much about the process and films, and why or why not they would do what they were supposed to be doing. And what was interesting was the fact that I was confronted with questions that had nothing to do with what I was doing. I mean, really. There were questions about theory of cinema, historical research, and they were very happy how I defended it at all, but made me thinking about how people are actually weaponized to ask questions.
Again, this is something that's emerging, isn't it? Yes. The right questions to ask.
Yes, so I think that it's doubly difficult. It's difficult for the examiner and for the person in the VIVA, because it's not necessarily true. I mean, and my external had vast experience in documentary making, but I suspect not so much about what I am doing, which is science history, which is a different thing. So it was a very interesting discussion, actually.
Yeah. And Laura, how did you experience?
I submitted my thesis. I did quite a large thesis because I was doing case studies and It was about 70,000 words. But I had done two solo exhibitions as well during, and I had made a lot of work. And because I do performance, I was performing at festivals and trying things out. But I didn't put all of the work in. I put some of the kind of the significant pieces that I had made in appendices in on a USB stick, and so that they could look at it and they could describe the work. And then for the Viva, then I did a 30-minute performance, which was actually quite good because all my nerves went into that. And by the time I got to the actual like Viva, it was fine. So I did half an hour, and then they took a break and went and talked, and then we sat and discussed the work. But I don't know how much decision making was done based on the performance I had done that morning, or whether they had made their decision before the Viva. So I'm not quite sure how much it was swayed. Because then in my corrections, I was advised to write up the work a lot in not more detail in appendices, and reflect on I had to rewrite my chapter conclusions and signpost it to the practice to kind of bring the practice in more, because I did struggle with bringing the practice into the thesis, and that was probably, you know, I think that was probably maybe a lack of confidence as well, in the practice, because as well my supervisors were both theory based as well, so it was, you know, I was I did lack a lot of confidence in the work, which I shouldn't have, because in hindsight now, you know, in reflection, it was really good, but that's okay, that's all right, because then I had the opportunity to go back and rewrite my conclusions and kind of really bring in why I made the decisions throughout the practice, and yeah, be a bit prouder of the practice that I had made throughout, because I was always very defensive of making any proclamations about the work when I was making it throughout. I always called my work an experiment, and my supervisor was like, it's not an experiment, this is, you know, this is a piece of work. I'm like, it's never finished, you know, it's always kind of in process. So I did struggle with that, because you're coming into an academic field as someone who practices, and my MFA wasn't really, I didn't write anything, my MFA was through practice. So I did struggle with finding that, but I think, you know, it worked out quite well. And my external examiner was an artist in the field, and he would have known my work in the past, so it was really good to have.
And just briefly, I'm sure most people are aware, people aren't, the internal examiner and external examiner will have a conversation. It's an opportunity to have an open and honest conversation where you might say, look, I'm not this bit here. And so by the time you get into the Viva, that's all been ironed out, and it's a robust process in that sense. I don't want to give the impression that, you know, somebody just turns up going, oh, I don't know anything about that part of it at all. It's worked out.
I think one thing about the Viva, I mean, I've obviously experienced a Viva, and I've been examining, which hasn't been just, you know, for about a year now. And I'm kind of wondering if, because you can always critique films, and it's basically films that I get of one sort or another, but would one actually ask for changes? And I have never done that so far. But you're still critiquing, but is that up to them? And I'm not sure. It would be interesting to hear other people's experience of you.
That's a fascinating thought about what you ask to be changed and how much more needs to be invested in the process then.
Yeah, I think so. Because films or practice is fairly open-ended. I wouldn't say that there was ever a point where, you know, something could be different, maybe stronger in some way or other. And one, as a practitioner, you tend to always think your past work could have been improved by hindsight. But for an examiner to actually ask for changes seems to be beyond the pale to me. But I don't know, because, you know, we're talking about knowledge here.
I think they rarely would, because there's an assumption, rightly or wrongly, that the work is the work, and the reason why so many people have the supplementary writing is for that reason, that the work is fixed now and can't be changed, but the writing could. But you are then, it's an interesting discussion, I think, about what would happen if you submitted only the film. because then there is nothing else to change. But then often the dilemma is resolved by the person being asked to provide some supplementary writing. I haven't been aware of a case where anyone's been asked to change the practice itself, you know, in retrospect, or do something new to it.
I don't think I've ever heard of an institution, actually, which would never have any supplementary writing. It's usually... I supervise professional doctorates, and they do a far smaller piece of writing, and it's very specific about where they've exhibited and all that kind of thing. So the theoretical side is quite short. I think the whole thing is the 20,000 words that they give. And their vivas sort of over the body of work and exhibitions and etc. they've done over the 5 years. I don't think in that situation that changes are asked for in the actual production of practice. It's surprising to me actually how many different types of PhDs there are, which is quite interesting.
You've been listening to a roundtable discussion at the University College Cork Film and Screen Media Creative Practice Symposium on the 4th of May 2018. This podcast is produced with each new issue of the Alphaville Journal of Film and Screen Media. Alphaville is a fully peer-reviewed, open-access online journal edited and published by staff, PhD and postdoctoral researchers in film and screen media at University College Cork, Ireland. This podcast, along with every back issue of the journal, can be found at www.alphavillejournal.com. Thanks for listening.